Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's The Wonky Show. We're talking PAC on OFS, IFS on student support, belonging, and all the latest action for the free speech bill. It's all coming up.
They're not being based on accurate reflective data. Students are being ignored when anyone talks about the cost of living. Well, the only person who talks about it is Jim Dickinson, who's been shouting about it for quite some time. But it's not being mentioned anywhere inside or outside the sector. Like, the HEPI conference last week had Michelle Donnellan there, and she said nothing about this at all.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, and joining me to untangle the acronym spaghetti of HE policy news this week are three fabulous guests as always. In Reading, it's Ben Elgar, Chief Executive of the Office for the Independent Adjudicator. Ben, your hire for the week, please.
Hi, Mark. So on Saturday, I was invited to the summer ball of my former employer, Reading University Students Union. The first for 3 years, absolutely brilliant to see it up and running again. And they were even able to gather and congratulate the sabbatical officer team of all the 3 years, which clearly meant a lot to all of them. So it was rather fantastic.
Lovely. I have been to the Reading Student Union Summer Ball and had a blast. In Gravesend, it's Selina Bolingbroke, HE consultant. Selina, your hire for the week.
I went with theatre performance on a lighting ship in the Thames Estuary at the weekend. And I watched a bit of drama musical about the lost communities of Sheppey, which is not something you do every week.
And in Sheffield, it's Sunday Blake, Wonky's associate editor. Sunday, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week absolutely was the event we ran yesterday with Pearson on our belonging research, which was so much fun. We had such good discussion with all the attendees, which I think sign-ups were nearly at 700, which was amazing. And yeah, lots of engagement, lots of food for thought. So yeah, really buzzing from that.
More on that later. Now, we start the week with a big Public Accounts Committee report on OFS and higher education. Selina, talk us through it.
Yes, Mark. This is a report that could be subtitled Nobody's Happy. PAC's not happy. DfE are not happy. Students aren't happy. And no doubt, having been pretty much slated in this report, OFS aren't happy either. So the Public Accounts Committee, which has a Labour chair, Meg Hillier, but actually, you know, 9 out of 16 members are Tories on the Public Accounts Committee. So a good mix there. They have criticised the OFS for not making sufficient progress in getting a grip on the long-term problems facing the sector. And they've also criticised the DfE for failing to hold OFS properly to account. So what they're highlighting in this report is the long-term financial viability, which has been caused by an increase in the proportion of institutions with in-year deficits from 7% in 2015-16 to a whopping 32% in 2019-20, which is, of course, the year before the impacts of COVID hit institutions. They make 6 recommendations in their report. It is a fairly snappy report. They actually only took evidence from, I think it was just 3 people from the sector, including the OFS. But what they're really highlighting here is a number of things. One is the sector's reliance on income from overseas students, and that there are issues around that in terms of the UK's geopolitics. The other thing is about insufficient protection for students when their institutions face financial distress, and in particular around the implementation of student protection plans. And then the third issue really is around falling student satisfaction, particularly in relation to value for money.
So, yeah, there's a lot in this, isn't there, Ben? Do you think it's a fair charge that OFS is not, it's a financial viability of the sector, kind of OFS's responsibility to kind of stop? Or is it just the regulator and, you know, it's kind of university's fault for, I guess, you know, the pressures they're under, not maybe mismanagement or what have you?
Well, obviously, there have been immense financial challenges through the last period. What I really did welcome in this, actually, is that there is a focus on the effect, the impact of the financial stability actually on individual students. I think we sort of went through a bit of a stage, didn't we, where it was almost, we were talking about it like a sort of badge of honour for the market if providers were lost. And given this really difficult experiences around GSM, Allied Drama School, going bust, which would have been even worse, actually, if other providers hadn't stepped in to take the students, I was really pleased to see that focus. I still think there is a genuine risk of a situation where students are left without redress or remedy at all. And that's something that the OIA, we've been calling for a sort of sector-wide insurance fund to help students in that situation. And perhaps that's something actually where the government and the regulator, and as you say, the sector, actually need to come together over that.
I think that I'd like to commend the Public Accounts Committee for doing what we'd all love to do, which is tell the Office of Students to get a grip. but really important comments, I think, about the over-reliance on international students. And I know that they're talking about long-term health and viability of the sector here, but I think that it's also important to acknowledge that, you know, international students are overtly aware that they are the ones footing the bill and keeping the whole operation afloat. They know this. You talk to any student, they know this. And I think one of the things that we just need to be really aware of is when you have a group of students who feel that they're disproportionately being relied on to fund things, and then they have a dissatisfying student experience, which a lot of them also do, they have even higher levels of resentment. And that's something that, you know, institutions or the sector has to deal with further on the line. So I think it's really important to note that, you know, students are very, very aware that this is happening.
There's a tension here, though, isn't there, that the report highlights about the role of OFS and its kind of place in government and the sector. I mean, Selena, the report says that DfE needs to hold OFS more properly to account on one hand. On the other hand, lots of people are concerned about exactly that in terms of, you know, the government holding OFS to account, or in other words, interfering politically with the work of the regulator. And Susan Lapworth pushed back against that charge this week. I guess, you know, where's the right balance here? Because on the one hand, PAC wants a greater role for DfE. On the other, the sector wants kind of, you know, OFS to have that much more independence from, you know, the political machinations.
Yeah, I would highlight the first sentence of the PAC report's introduction, which says universities and other higher education providers are autonomous institutions with a high degree of financial as well as academic independence. And I think this comes back to what are, you know, essentially structural or at the very least systemic tensions within the system. And, you know, one of the things that's not returned to enough in it with this government, or, you know, this parliament in particular, is the going back to the origins of policy. And, you know, I think the origins of policy here are 11 years ago when Students at the Heart of the System was published. And it's really quite clear, I think, to everyone, whichever way you look at this, that 11 years on, students are still not at the heart of the system. There are some baked-in tensions that are not going to be resolved without real structural change. So even here, where PAC is exposing the financial vulnerability and the vulnerability of students in terms of protection from that financial crisis, it's not really addressing what is at the root cause of that vulnerability. And at its most straightforward, it's the simple business equation, isn't it? In terms of, you've got rising costs, of which those costs are not going to, you know, those pressures are not going to go away. You've got a falling unit of resource for the majority of university activity. And you've got students who, you know, when they're assessed essentially about their views, about quality, about value for money, they are in the final year of their degree, they are still students. Wait until they are graduates and they've looked at their first loan statement with all of its accrued interest in the next few years, and then think about how they feel about that value for money then. I think that this is something that, you know, that we are not in the time of politics that anybody is going to be bold enough to bring about the radical change that is required. But I don't think that takes away from the fact that we are still at a point where making tweaks here and there is not really going to change the bigger picture on higher education. And alas, I think it is going to be a source of discontent for all stakeholders over the next few years.
Ben, as we've got you, do you wake up in a cold sweat at night imagining a public accounts committee coming for the
OIA? I was too busy worrying about what you were going to ask me on the wonky show, actually, Mark. But I think you know, we all obviously have to be accountable, and certainly we're very aware that our role has become, you know, much more visible and in some ways more central in the last couple of years. And I hope that we've shown a willingness to explain, you know, what we're doing and why we're doing it. And certainly one of the things we found in the pandemic time in particular is that getting out information, explaining what we can do, what we can't do, what our role is, what our role isn't, and how we were deciding cases, you know, has been seen as helpful by sector, government, student organisations.
Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, I'm Catherine Harrison-Graves, Executive Director for Membership, Innovation and Development at AdvanceHE. One of my areas of work includes overseeing the revisions to the Professional Standards Framework for Teaching and Supporting Learning in Higher Education, or the PSF. Since its inception in 2006, the PSF has developed and evolved. It was previously reviewed in 2011, and there are now almost 160,000 fellows that have had their practice recognised against the PSF across the globe. The learning and teaching landscape has changed considerably since the current version of the PSF was published in 2011. So earlier this year, the team at AdvanceHE committed to facilitating a sector-led review of the Professional Standards Framework. We're now entering the second phase of consultation and are inviting colleagues from across the sector to provide feedback on a revised draft of the framework via a survey which is accessed via the AdvanceHE website. The survey is open till the 17th of July, and I'd really encourage anyone with an interest to participate and help ensure the framework continues to serve the sector both now and in the future.
James Coe's here to tell us what's going on with Horizon.
Hello, it's James from Team Wonky calling in on Horizon Europe, what association looks like, whether it's possible or not. So, earlier this week, Oslein Laser, the Chief Executive UKRI, and George Freeman, Minister for Science, Research and Innovation, both appeared before the Science and Technology Committee to discuss diversity in STEM, funding and association to Horizon. Now, anybody who's been following research in the sector will know that Association to Horizon is the government's Plan A. They've said again and again it is their priority. They think it is the best result for the UK. The funding for it was agreed in the most recent spending review, and in theory, there are no internal political constraints to preventing association. But it gets more complicated with the proposed ripping up of the Northern Ireland Protocol. The EU Commission see this as an unacceptable breach of the Brexit Treaty, and in return, it seems unlikely that association to Horizon will be possible until this and other political issues are resolved. This has led to George Freeman in consultation with parts of the sector working on what he is calling Plan B. Now, Plan B doesn't seem entirely clear just yet, but in theory, it is meant to capture the best parts of Horizon, with more emphasis on flexible funding for researchers and research, more international collaboration, backed up by new infrastructure investment. We were told in the Select Committee appearance that if there are enough signals of association by the summer, then it will be necessary to look at Plan B in earnest. If Plan B is to come in, the interregnum period moving between the current system and a new system will begin in September 2022. This will take between a year and 18 months, so it should be the case that by 2024 we've moved over to a new funding arrangement. The concern for the sector, of course, is that in that time, there'll be funding, partnerships and opportunities that are lost, adding to the general uncertainty about research at the moment. Although we are no further forward, this is clearly going to be one to watch.
Now, we've published the latest tranche of research into belonging and inclusion at University Sunday. Talk us through the headlines.
Okay, this is something I'm really, obviously really excited about, as I've previously mentioned. So this is basically, we've been tracking for a year now, for the academic year, a diverse group of students. as they come back onto campus. Now, this was looking at how they reacclimatize post-COVID, but we've also been looking at like more long-standing issues around belonging and inclusion as they've come up as well. It's national survey data. I think we're clocking up to about 6,000 participants now, made up of staff and students. And by staff, I mean academics, professional service staff, and student union staff as well. On Wednesday, we held an event with Pearson, which looked at the key findings. So these findings were essentially looking at things like sense of belonging, academic confidence, and also peer networks. I personally feel that the peer network findings are the most important. And I know that we'll be releasing these findings in full on Monday, and my colleague Jim will be writing a blog about specifically the peer networks and connections and whose responsibility it lies to foster those. For me, one of the most interesting things is that when these discussions were first happening, particularly around COVID time, so we were talking about students accessing their course materials online, but then saying that, you know, they feel lonely or they feel isolated. And there was a lot of sort of back and forth about, well, whose responsibility is that students have friends, right? That was how it was interpreted. But actually, when you look at what some of the students are saying in this research, they're not actually talking about friendships. They're talking about being part of a learning community. And I think that one of the things that's got to come out of this research, which I think is going to be very beneficial moving forward for the sector, is a real clear delineation that the students themselves make between their courses and being part of a community on a course that you can contribute to, that you can be part of, that you can discuss the course material with, you know, that sort of thing, is very, very different from friendship groups. And that's across the board, right? That's not just 18-year-old school leavers who have their housemates and their course mates. That is also coming from participants who are mature students who are saying, you know, I've got friends, I've got a supportive spouse, I've got my children, I don't need to come here to socialise, but I do want to be part of a learning community. And this all comes back to a sense of belonging that for many students, and this came out so, so clearly right at the beginning of the research, and it's just carried on throughout, that students feel a sense of belonging, not when they attend university, but when they are actively doing something for the university, right? So it's when you start to give back, or you co-produce the university environment, whether that's through co-production of knowledge on a project, whether that's being an ambassador, working in the student bar came up as well. It's that sense of belonging. It is enhanced when you become, well, part of the community, right? So yeah, that's what I find the most interesting part. And actually, when it comes to responsibility of who to foster that, whose responsibility is it to foster that, it becomes everyone's responsibility, including the students themselves. Because there is a little bit of backlash around, especially particularly around academic workloads. And we have to be really careful with that, because obviously there's industrial action going on about that at the minute. But yeah, it's not, what the task that we're asking is not the task that students want, if that makes sense.
And looking at the research that we published from the staff survey, I mean, there's a lot of agreement, isn't there, Selena, from kind of staff and students that relationship is really key. So the staff survey that we're publishing now kind of backs up the earlier finding that we understood students really recognize that the relationship and the contact they have with their the academics on their course and the people in the department is so powerful when it comes to their feelings of belonging and inclusion. And that's something to build on, isn't it?
Yeah, it is something to build on. And I think it's worth acknowledging that probably over the last sort of 20 years, I mean, it's been a kind of gradual creep, I guess, accelerated in some universities and not so much in others. But there is an atomization of the student experience and indeed the staff experience. I mean, I think that's been the more recent thing. I was somebody who went on one of the very early modular degrees in the 1990s. And I think I absolutely understand what Sundee picks up as the distinctions between friendship groups and learning peers, because I think that was one of the very early challenges then. And I think it's more of a challenge now simply because of the pressures, not just around course attendance, but, you know, life survival and fitting in part-time jobs and all the rest of it. But I think that what would be a really sensible way to approach this is for universities to think at the point of degree validation, course design, how you design these elements as an integral part of the program in a way that has the kind of requisite flexibility that is required, but that it is very clear for students who come on that program that, first of all, the university will put forward, if you like, I'd call it a kind of structured pathway. They wayfind how those peer networks are created, and they value what those peer networks create. And when I say value, I think, you know, it's always good to have assessment as part of the valuation scheme for that, because that means students get used to taking those things seriously. But it is a really important part of that learning journey, and there's plenty of research out there. I know I came across some from Exeter University a few years ago that showed there was demonstrable effects on student attainment at the end of the first year, more so with students who came from a non-traditional HE background, because they hadn't engaged in those peer networks and they hadn't done the kind of accidental stuff that full-time students without lots of other responsibilities got to do.
Ben, this I'd be fascinated in your take on this, because I'm guessing that, you know, the better that the sector gets at fostering belonging and inclusion, ultimately the less work you're going to have to do at the Office Absolutely. Of Independent Adjudicator, right?
Work. And I was so interested in the new connections and peer relationships bit as well. And I really think that possibly we all underestimated, especially pre-pandemic, just how key some of those things that go on, not in classes, but sort of around and in the margins of classes, how important they are. And another thing I picked out, it's very interesting stuff around personal tutors and what's the role of personal tutors and what's the role of other tutors. And I think there's a sort of ongoing debate there, isn't there, about where the personal tutor system starts or stops, and whether it is really systematic, and what needs to come in from student services and increasing pastoral roles in those areas. And I think, you know, the fact that universities and providers are giving that so much consideration is, as you say, a real way of sort of stopping complaints at source.
You can read all the research on wonky.com. You can find links in the show notes. We're publishing, as Sunday said, more on Monday and more to come in September. Now, the influential Institute for Fiscal Studies has a new report on student support, largely cribbed, I should say, from the pages of Wonky. Not that we're bitter, but Ben, talk us through its main findings.
Right at the sharp end of the student funding debate, its assessment of student maintenance support shows it to be its lowest level in real terms for 7 years, principally due to the use of out-of-date inflation predictions at a time of obviously rising inflation, meaning students will receive up to £1,200 less than if up-to-date metrics have been used. They also point out the situation is compounded by the continuing freezing of the parental earnings threshold, so fewer students can actually access the maximum loan, and the decision not to implement proposals from the Augar review that would have brought back a level of student grant or linked maintenance support to the national minimum wage. But the biggest question seems to be, how can it be justified to use out-of-date predictions to this effect when newer ones have been available for some time?
And who is going to do anything about the massive squeeze on students? Any ideas? I'm genuinely asking.
I mean, I think for me, what's worrying, and I think one of the things that contributes to this, or one of the things that contributes to the inaction, is that there's this horrid, persistent sort of idea that it's like a rite of passage to be skint as a student. And it's that kind of like baked in, baked bean stereotype. And I think that we need to challenge that because this report obviously is directly related to the cost of living crisis, right? Like, student living and maintenance costs are something that is also that's being ignored. That, you know, they're not being based on accurate reflective data. Students are being ignored when anyone talks about the cost of living. Well, the only person who talks about it is Jim Dickinson, who's been shouting about it for quite some time. But it's not being mentioned anywhere inside or outside the sector. Like the HEPI conference last week had Michelle Donnellan there and she said nothing about this at all. And then yesterday, the questions that she was given in the education committee, again, not one person asked about the cost of living, the impact of students and how their maintenance and student finance is being worked out. And I think this is a little bit tangential to the report, but it is related to like the oversight of real time student costs, because I actually don't think students are that worried about loans. From, you know, the ones that I talk to, everyone talks about loans, but they are more of like an abstract amount of money that you know, it's going to come off their paychecks in the future. But right now, the cost of living is really pressing. And I think that higher education providers are going to get more and more hardship fund applications in the short term. You know, how will the sector or government provide guidance around this? Is it going to be a postcode lottery? Like, depending on which institution you're at, depends if you get help or not. Because it's going to have, I can't remember what study it was, but there was a study that came out really recently that said that the stress that you undergo with financial concerns as a student can actually contribute to long-term anxiety disorders, as if student anxiety wasn't high enough, you know? And then we've already got mental health issues in the sector, which the institutions will be expected to fix with well-funded wellbeing services. And then students themselves obviously are going to be working more hours, more part-time jobs. They may be turned into unregulated high-risk work like sex work or drug running, which can lead to more issues for them. Dropout rates will go up. I know I'm catastrophizing right now, but it is something that more people other than Jim Dickinson on Twitter threads should be talking about, because students live in the financial context of the real world. They don't live in a bubble. You know, it's not.
Yeah. And I mean, the RFS does suggest some easy fixes for this. So, for example, sorting out inflation. So using more recent forecasts so that at the moment, what's happening is that students are going to be eligible for smaller maintenance loans because parents have had real terms falls in their income, but cash rises. And sort of this nasty sort of hidden inflation effect that means that students are going to get less support. So there are some fixes, aren't there?
I think it comes back to, actually Cindy mentioned it, much of what she says I agree with in terms of it being an issue that not enough people are talking about. It's not getting the political attention that it should. But it seems that the only time that students get attention is when that student demand falls away in a way that will impact on institutions. So I think that that's problematic, because I can't see how this is going to turn itself into a priority issue, given all of the other competing demands around the cost of living crisis. That doesn't diminish it in any way at all. And I think, you know, Sunday's right to catastrophize. But I just worry that, you know, there will be very little done around this until it starts to break the system, because applications do start to turn. But I don't think that's going to happen in the next few years.
Now, David Kernahan from the team is also here to talk to us about graduate outcomes data.
It is fair to say that we were all more than usually interested in the 2019-20 release of graduate outcomes. This, after all, was the cohort that saw the last days of their course with emergency remote learning and that suffered with online assessments, with some of these sudden shifts mitigated via no detriment policies. On graduating in the early summer of 2020, they entered a job market and indeed an economy unlike anything that had ever been seen before. On taking their collective temperature 15 months on, what did we learn about how they did? The word I find myself reaching for is normal. A word used advisedly. There have only been 3 releases of graduate outcomes, and each has been special in its own way. But as an emerging time series, you wouldn't exactly spot the pandemic unless you knew what to look for. Response rates were slightly down, just 48% overall across the sector. But what graduates were doing was pretty similar to last year and the year before. The clues were there, however. The benefit of advantaged backgrounds are beginning to be seen around the edges of what had previously looked like a testament to equality of opportunity. Though state school educated graduates were still slightly more likely than their privately educated peers to have a full-time job, there is now a 5 percentage point gap when it comes to further study. You need, it seems, a well-off family to stay on to do postgraduate work. The much-decried grade inflation doesn't appear to have had an impact on early career employment. Despite stern warnings to the contrary, employers seem to be taking 2019-20 first as equivalent to firsts in any other year. I was surprised to note computing as the academic field of study most likely to lead to unemployment, and that psychology is the major subject most likely to land you a low-skilled, so-called job. But what we really need to be concerned about is graduate anxiety. Already high, the last 2 years have seen it rise to alarming levels. And if you wanted to design a graduate outcomes-based intervention, as a regulator, I'd be sorely tempted to do something to address the mental health needs of recent graduates. As always, there's lots more on the site, including my usual range of visualizations.
Now, the free speech bill is motoring its way through Parliament now. Selina, what's the latest progress?
At third reading at the moment, and basically there have been amendments that mean that OFS will now get powers to address concerns around the impact of overseas funding on academic freedom. So the talk is that any income above £75,000 requires some declaration. So this would give the Secretary of State the power to terminate partnerships between universities and overseas partners if overseas partners were found to be stifling freedom of speech. There are a couple of other sort of technical amendments there in terms of who is now included within the category of academic staff. So it will include visiting and honorary members. And the other significant government amendment that has gone through is that universities or student unions will not be able to use the high cost of security as a reason to cancel events. There were some opposition amendments, but they were not accepted. Probably the other amendment that I'm pretty sure was accepted that is worth mentioning, I think it did have all-round support, but it was the Jess Phillips amendment, which outlawed NDAs in sexual misconduct cases. And I know there's been quite a lot on the wonky blogs around that issue. So, yes, there's also a blog that DK and Jim have put together, which rightly says we have watched the third stage reading, so you don't have to. But yes, it seems to be somewhat sailing through now.
And despite all these amendments, in your opinion, is it, you know, any less of a steaming pile of turd? More of a comment than a question.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that makes it hard to kind of answer. But I tell you what, I think the thing is, it's not so much, is it, about the contents of this bill. It's a distraction from all the other issues that are of far more importance that we've talked about earlier in this show that have no policy attention at all.
And yeah, the interesting thing for me is that the government have opened applications for the director of free speech and academic freedom, which is the position at OFS that the bill creates. And lots of fascinating stuff in the intercandidate pack. Are any of you planning on applying?
As you could imagine, but I do still have a bit of
course you have. Of course you have. Then
how that role is going to work as both a kind of champion agitator and an end-line adjudicator ombuds, which might sound a bit kind of OIA technical, but it is quite hard to understand how, if your role is kind of to root out and almost promote and find issues with free speech, how you're then going to be able to sit down at the end of that process and make objective judgments. And that, you know, that is an issue we have raised a lot, and in fairness we are being, you know, we're being spoken to about, and I think we'll carry on talking, you know, not just to DfE but eventually to OFS about. But that does feel like quite an important issue, and it sort of compounds the other issue we have, which is that there could be quite a lot of confusion for students about when they should be going through the OFS route and when they should be coming to the OIA, because so often free speech complaints are not really just going to be about free speech, but going to wrap up lots of other issues.
One of the criteria that I quote is experience of one or more of the following, and I'll just paraphrase, operating complaints or other ombudsman style schemes.
Important that if there is going to be an ombuds type role, that we are looking for an ombuds type person. As I say, I think the way the thing is set up could make that role quite difficult, though.
But I mean, it's in everyone's interest for someone who to approach it in the spirit of that ombuds type role, as you say, isn't it? I mean, it's I guess the fear is that essentially a kind of free speech. I'm not even sure what the word to use. You know, a crank, free speech crank, should we call, you know, those people who just live and breathe this problem, and they believe, you know, it is the kind of the thin end of the wedge of, you know, all that is wrong with Britain in 2022. You know, who want to just crack down and, you know, make it their life's work. That's kind of, I guess that's the worry, isn't it? It's not that it's not going to kind of be someone sensible to look at these cases as they come up and make impartial decisions. It's that, someone's going to use it as another political stick.
I think that's absolutely right, Mark. The number of times in the passage of the bill where it's been said, well, that will be down to the individual in that role to make those difficult and fine judgments, has been really noticeable, hasn't it?
Well, I'm labouring this point because of this reason. I think it is kind of really crucial that someone sensible, like the good listeners of the Wonky Show, all of you, all of which are very, very sensible, I'm sure. And you can find details in the show notes on how to apply and more details about this. It's a strange job, but well paid, 100 grand or so, something like that. I seem to recall. So yeah, it has its upsides. I'm clearly not going to push any of you any further on that.
Definitely,
you heard it
not.
Here first.
I mean, it's only marginally less attractive than becoming the advisor on ethics, another hard to fill vacancy, right?
Yeah. Difficult decision for Selena this weekend, which of these roles to go into.
I think the thing is, it's like I know that we've said this with so many times, and it's so transparently political as to what it is. But I think for me, as Selena did mention this earlier. But, you know, I disagree with a lot of Jess Phillips' policies, but I had to hand it to her that she absolutely smashed her amendment, and I will present in her amendment. And what I liked about it, because again, I mean, like so many incidences before, it really pointed out how utterly contradictory this legislation is. And, you know, by mentioning that she'd brought up NDAs and institutions using Zelic principles. And she, you know, she had that meeting with Michelle, who, and Michelle said, oh, you know, these are things that legislation can't fix. We can't legislate for these things. And yet she turned around to the Free Speech Higher Education Bill, and I can't remember what she called it, but she called it something like sector changing or something, or whatever phrase she used to make it a big ticket item for herself. But yeah, I think I watched the whole session, and that moment I thought, one, I agree with what Jess is pushing for, and I think that she's bang on the money with that. But two, I thought it was just another example of how this is only being weaponized in the political ways that this current sitting government and their supporters want it to be. And actually, it's not being, you know, applied across the board. So, yes, I'm exhausted with this. Everyone's exhausted with it. But it's just it's another tally on the contradiction chart for this bill. So thank you, Jess Phillips, for that.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscription services. So, thanks very much to Ben, Selena, Sunday and everyone at Team Wonky that makes the show happen. Until next week, stay wonky.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack. for free shipping and 365-day returns.